The title of today's sermon is Such a Time as This. And brethren, in these last days, as we draw nearer and nearer to the return of Jesus Christ, we are going to be experiencing greater and greater trials and tests, difficulties that come on us. They're going to come on us in the church of God. They're going to come on our nation. They're going to come on our people as well. I'd like to begin today in the book of Habakkuk, because this is not just something that is unique to our last days. The prophets of old, and Habakkuk was one of the 12 minor prophets, and Habakkuk felt some of these same things. But you know, when I talk to the brethren, already we're saying things like, things are so bad, we need God to intervene, we need deliverance, everything's getting out of hand. It's getting worse and worse every day. And there's just no justice. Nothing's fair anymore. And then our prayer to God is, God, you've got to step in and do something. And that's exactly how Habakkuk felt. He kept pleading with God, but from his point of view, to no avail. Habakkuk 1 and verse 2, we'll just look at a few of these verses. Habakkuk is praying, he's pleading with God. He says, "Oh Lord, how long shall I cry?" In other words, how long shall I cry out to you, just pleading with you, and you will not hear? So it's rather condemnatory, but he felt like, you know, God wasn't hearing his prayer. Even cry out unto thee of violence, and you will not save. You know, you're God of mercy and love, and there's violence here, and you're not putting a stop to it. Verse 3, why do you show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? So he's seeing all of this trouble at his time, too. He says, we need some intervention down here, Lord, for spoiling and violence are before me. Brethren, we think it's bad now, but we are going to see more spoiling, more violence. We have had preciously preserved lives, preserved from violence. Yes, it's getting worse, and it's going to get much worse. But see, the violence was before Habakkuk. And there are those that raise up strife and contention. There's just people who are going to start a fight over every single thing. Verse 4, therefore the law is slack, and judgment does never go forth. It says you just never get a break in the courts, the judges, the police, the lawyers. It just never works out fair. The bad guys get off. The good guys are punished. Continuing in the middle of verse 4, for the wicked doth compass about the righteous. You know, they're all around us. All the bad guys are around the people that are trying to live godly lives. Therefore, wrong judgment proceeds. You know, see, the crooked courts, crooked lawyers. And it was that day way back at the time of Habakkuk. So it's nothing new that we're experiencing today. And the point that I'm making is it is going to get worse. Habakkuk did live in a time when he saw much more than we see. He had seen Israel go into captivity. He saw what it was like to have the Chaldeans rise up in power and threaten. Well, we don't realize yet to what extent the enemy is rising up against us. Some of us are trying to encourage one another. We're looking, we're seeing. But in his day, it was upon them. So God explains, then he answers Habakkuk, that he is going to send the Chaldeans to punish his people, Judah, Benjamin, Levi, and so forth, and that it's going to get much worse. Verse 5, behold you among the heathen, and regard and wonder marvelously, for I'll work a work in your days which you will not believe even though I told it to you. So he said, you wouldn't believe what's going to happen. Verse 6, for lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation. Okay, they're an enemy. You know, we might equate it with the Germans or the enemies that can overpower us, which shall march through the breadth of the land. Well, we have been touched on our land at 9/11. The enemy has touched our soil over here in America, but we haven't had the enemy march through the breadth of our land, march across us yet. But they will, to possess thy dwelling places that are not theirs. You know, you think it's your house, that's where you live, these scriptures say it is going to get so bad, somebody else is going to live in your house. That's the way I read that scripture. Verse 7. They're terrible and dreadful. You can't put the right inflection on that. I remember on 9/11 when the planes were hitting the towers and so forth, I thought to myself, what if they keep coming and coming and coming? How big is this? How many directions are they going to come from? Well, that's what this first part of verse 7 means. They're terrible and dreadful. There's no stopping them. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. They're boastful. They talk about how great they are. You can just see that chin jutting out. You know, there's no stopping them. And so God tells Habakkuk that this is also, not just for his day, but it's also a prophecy for the end time, brethren. So turn over to verse 13. This is a very interesting verse that I don't know that I've keyed in on it before. It's a whole lot like Isaiah 59, too. But I'd just like you to have it in your notes. Habakkuk 1 and verse 13. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil. So Habakkuk is saying to God, you know, you don't even let any sin come in your presence. You're not going to look at anything evil. And you cannot look on iniquity, you know, because sin separates, you know, iniquity from God, us from God when we've been sinful. Wherefore, look thou upon them that deal treacherously, and hold thy tongue when the wicked devours the man that is more righteous than he. In other words, you know, how do you let the bad guys win over the good guys is what Habakkuk says. And so then in chapter 2, Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 3, God says, look, this prophecy is for the end time as well. For the vision is yet for an appointed time. But at the end, it shall speak, not lie. Though it tarries, you know, it's been a long time, wait for it, because it will surely come. It's not going to tarry. So, brethren, that's where we are today. Behold, his soul, which is lifted up, is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. And, brethren, I just have a few scriptures that you might like to put in your notes. Romans chapter 1 and verse 17, where Paul quotes that about the just living by faith. And verse 18, next verse as well. It says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. It will come. The righteousness of God will punish the evildoers who hold back the truth in unrighteousness. So in other words, Romans 1:18 is saying God is going to even up the score one of these days, and only more so. We can rest assured that God's in charge. God knows the score. He's going to take care of it. But there's something much bigger that's being worked out. God's hand is in a lot of things. And that's the purpose of my sermon today, to talk about how God's hand is in all of these things, even though it seems like God is far away. Hebrews chapter 10, brethren, if you'll turn over there, Paul is describing in saying these words that are written down in Hebrews, that it's talking about living in faith. And it's not my purpose to speak about faith so much today as it is the knowing that God is involved in everything that's going on for those of us who are the brethren, the saints of God. Hebrews 10 and verse 36. For you have need of patience, that after you have done the will of God, you might receive the promise. So I imagine everybody hearing my voice is saying, I've done the will of God. I've been in the church a long time. Be patient even then that you might receive the promise. Verse 37, for yet a little while, and he that shall come will come and will not tarry. They're very similar words that we saw just a while ago. Verse 38. Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul has no pleasure in him. So don't give up. You know, keep up the good fight, as we say, verse 39. But we are not of them who draw back into perdition, but of them that believe to the saving of the soul, or to the saving of our lives. So you don't join the fight. You don't get in the brawl and give back the same as you receive. We might be tempted to say, you know, they were crooked, I'll be crooked back. They were mean, I'll be mean back. That's what he's saying. You know, don't draw back into perdition like they have. Brethren, why is it that at this particular time God has called us to a knowledge of the truth? He's called us even to be his children, even now. This is a calling, and it's a privilege. It's a tremendous privilege, and it carries the reward of salvation with it. But let's understand something. God the Father has not called us at this time expressly for the purpose of salvation. He didn't say, you know what? I like the way that one looks. I like the way this person sounds. I'm going to go ahead and save them, and I'm not going to save the rest. I just have my favorites. God is not a respecter of persons. If God was calling a few of us for salvation and not the rest, there would be something inherently unfair about that. But God is always totally fair and just. We have been called. We have been drawn. We've been recruited by God for some other purposes. And they're his purposes. And that's what we're going to see in today's message. God is calling us for things that he is working out. And we don't always see it so clearly. Just like Habakkuk was saying, I don't see what's going on, Lord. It doesn't look right to me. So it behooves us to ask the question, why has God called me now? For what purpose has he drawn me into his good graces? Why am I privileged to have his spirit? His spirit to lead me, to guide me, and to teach me. Brethren, our lives are to be a witness of what God is doing. Every one of us in the church of God is necessary to what God is achieving. That is why he called us. He called us because we are necessary to his plan, to what he is going to accomplish. That is why God says for us not to bury our talents. Now, he didn't give us our talents so that we could be boastful or great or visible, any of those kind of things. The purpose of today's sermon is for us to see that God is actively working all around our lives and in our lives, and that we have an essential part to perform in his plan. He didn't just call us to sit here and watch what was going on. We don't know exactly how God is using us in every case. We might be an example to someone. We might be a witness to someone. We might be a teacher to someone. God might be letting us go through some trials now to be useful to him in the millennium. We don't know exactly what God's working out. He has the big picture. We have to have the faith that he does. We might not know in this lifetime who has been affected, touched, changed by our actions or our deeds or having come into contact with us. We don't always know. I believe we should worry about affecting people adversely and negatively because we're warned, you know, not to be stumbling blocks to people. But when we're doing what we're supposed to, keeping the Sabbath, loving God, serving one another. We don't know who's being touched, who's being affected, but God does. He's putting us where we are. He places us in the body where it pleases him so that his plan can be accomplished. And he doesn't reveal all the minute details to us. The idea is that there is a purpose to our calling, more than just our being saved right now. I think sometimes we in the Church of God live our lives like, you know, I'm in here. I don't want to rub shoulders with these people that are going to cause me to, you know, go off course, get angry. I'll just be an island unto myself, and it's me and you, Lord, and I'll go into the kingdom of God. We're not to be isolationists in the kingdom of God. That's the opposite of the fellowshipping that we're supposed to have with one another. We're called for a duty. We're called for a job. And it's a work that actually transcends the days in which we're living. What God has called us to do might go on and on and on. Just for example, look at what the apostles did, what they wrote down, what they were witness of. You know, we are living by the words that they put down, that they heard Christ say, and so forth. Their work transcended their days, went far beyond their lifetimes. Maybe some of the things that we're doing might do the same. And that's not a grandiose idea. You know, we do affect our children. We do affect the people that we come into contact with. And this work of God, led by His Spirit, is alive and growing, and it will go on even after we die. And so, brethren, we can expect the difficulties to intensify as we come to the time of the end, just as God told Habakkuk. It's going to get worse and worse. God gives everyone that He is working with duties and responsibilities, even Adam and Eve, but they failed to achieve what God wanted them to do. We know that story. And needless to say, there were terrible consequences as a result of Adam's disappointing performance in the Garden of Eden. However, what does need to be reiterated is the fact that when we fail to take a stand for God's way, we hamper the progress of the plan of God. If God puts a situation in front of us and we sidestep it, we run around it, we do an end run, then we didn't help God achieve what He's going to achieve. Now, He will get it achieved. We'll see in the Scriptures today. He will get it done, with or without us. But we don't want to be hampering the progress of what God is doing. That would, in effect, be jeopardizing our salvation, which we do receive at this time. Tremendous, unimaginable blessing, because God has called us and we do receive salvation, but that's not primarily why He has called us. Now, some people will say, you know, you're taking way too much upon yourself. God does not expect this great, magnificent performance from every one of us. Well, brethren, I think we all have to answer the question, you know, when we see something and God shows it to us, you know, will we handle it or will we walk away from it? Those are questions that we'll see in the Scriptures today are very, very important for us to consider. And I believe that, yes, He does. He does expect some tremendous performance from us. He's called us to specifically achieve certain of His goals. And if we don't do it, if we don't live up to His expectations, He's going to get somebody else to do it. That's just the way that it works. Let's look today at what the Scriptures reveal about the ordeal in which Queen Esther stood her ground and prevailed. We're pretty familiar with that story, but I think it would be good for us to go through that. If you turn over to the book of Esther and go ahead and put your marker there, that will be our Scripture for today. Now, there are some people who will tell you that God's name does not appear in the book of Esther. You can't find God. You can't find I Am. You can't find Lord. You can't find any of the names of God. They'll tell you that. But my answer to them is, don't you believe them? And I'm not speaking about where God's name appears hidden five times in acrostic. Now, acrostic is where you take the first letter of the word. Sometimes it's written backwards and so forth. But Yahweh is in there, in the book of Esther, in acrostics. It's in chapter 1, verse 20, and chapter 5, verse 4, and also in chapter 5, verse 13. And I Am, that's the name of God also, appears in acrostic in chapter 7, verses 5 and 7. But that's not what I'm talking about, seeing the presence of God or God's name in the book of Esther. We are going to see that even though Esther was a captive in a pagan civilization, God's imprint is everywhere in the book of Esther. And it has to do with what we've been talking about today, the plan of God being worked out and our, as individuals, part in what God's working out. So let's begin in chapter 1 of Esther. And the setting here at the book of Esther is that the nation of Judah has just been carried away captive. And why were they carried away captive? Because they didn't heed God's warning. There was Sabbath breaking. There was idolatry. And so God uses Nebuchadnezzar, and he comes in and he hauls them away into captivity. And this is some, let's just say, roughly 500 years before Jesus Christ. Esther 1 in verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even to Ethiopia, a tremendous large area, over 127 provinces. So he was a great king. Verse 2. That in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, Shushan is on the Tigris River, about 150 miles upriver from the head of the Persian Gulf. So you can picture that area of Iraq, Iran, Persia, and so forth in there. You can even go to a Google map and find the modern city. I think they call it Shush today instead of Shushan, but it's still there. Verse 3, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. So he brought everybody from all over that part of the civilized world that he ruled over. He brought them in for a tremendous feast. And when he showed them the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty, many days, even 180 days, it was a tremendous party, practically a half a year that it went on. And the reason he was doing this, the reason that King Ahasuerus was doing this, and we know him as Xerxes from profane history, is he's planning a war campaign against the Greeks, and he wants to impress all of these, as the Bible puts it, princes and servants. These are the generals, the war-making men over 127 nations. He's trying to bring them on board to go against the Greeks. I drop down to verse 12. So they're having this big feast, a lot of food, a lot of wine and everything. But the queen, Vashti, refused to come at the king's command by his chamberlains. And you can't hardly blame her. The king had drank too much. He made some unreasonable requests of Vashti. Therefore, the king was very angry, and his anger burned in him. He was really humiliated that she didn't come out and dance in front of all of these generals, because he was going to show her off. She was probably one of the most beautiful women in the world. We'll see that later. And now she wouldn't even come when the king called her. And he's the big, big, big wheel. And so he's terribly embarrassed. What to do? All the generals were wondering. All the chamberlains were wondering. You know, if you let the queen get away with that, all the women, all over the world, they're going to rebel. You know, they won't do what their husbands say. So let's go over to Esther chapter 2. They decide to get rid of Queen Vashti, hold a worldwide beauty pageant, and find another beautiful wife for the king. It seems at this point that the only thing he's interested in is their meticulous beauty. Esther 2 and verse 2. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace. Verse 4. And let the maiden which pleases the king, let her be queen instead of Vashti. And the king said, hey, that's a good deal. And so he did that. Verse 5. Now in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew. Well, now, Mordecai wasn't actually a Jew. He was a Benjamite, but they fell under the same generic heading as a Jew. They weren't from the tribe of Judah per se. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, but they were counted as Jews. They were known as Jews, just like today people get Israel and Judah mixed up. There was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jairus, son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. So there it is right there. And understand this, brethren, that when the southern nation of Israel, the tribe of Judah, known as Judea, went into captivity, it wasn't just Judah, but it also included contingents of Levi and Benjamin, as we see here. Now, brethren, the other 10 tribes of Israel had previously gone into Assyrian captivity, never to return to Jerusalem until the time of Christ's second coming. That's when they'll be gathered back together there. And so let me take a breath here and explain, brethren. These are clear warnings to us today. World events are building to another crescendo, just as they were at the time of Habakkuk, just as they had boiled over into captivity at the time of Queen Esther here. Let's continue in Esther 2 and verse 6. This is speaking about Mordecai, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. So they were over there in captivity. Verse 7. And he brought up Hadassah. And Hadassah, who we're going to see, is Esther. But Hadassah is her Hebrew name. But her Hebrew name is changed to a pagan name, Easter, when she's in captivity. Here it's spelled Esther, but it's really the pagan name for Easter. His uncle's daughter. Now that makes Esther and Mordecai first cousins. But he was much older than she was. And he was a father to her. He took her into his home. He nourished her. He raised her. We'll see that in just a second. For she, Esther, had neither father nor mother. They were probably killed in the carrying away of the captives or through the hardships or so forth. But in any case, she didn't have a mother or father. She was orphaned. And the maid, Esther, was fair. She was beautiful. Whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. So he was responsible for her, to raise her, to teach her, to train her up in the way that she should go. Esther 2 and verse 8. And so it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together, this is worldwide beauty contest, unto Shushan the palace, to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also into the king's house to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. Now, before this, Mordecai had warned Esther, don't let people know that you are Jewish, because there was tremendous anti-Semitism. It was rampant throughout that area. He wasn't always there to protect her, to take care of her. He said, don't tell anybody that you're Jewish. Verse 10, Esther had not showed her people, in other words, she hadn't showed that she was of Jewish stock, nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. Verse 11, and Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. So he would go to the door of the window, talk to the people, how's she doing, get word to them, and so forth. But, nobody was allowed to go back there where the young ladies were. Verse 12. Now, when every maid's turn was come to go into King Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months, according to the manner of women, for so were the days of their purifications accomplished, to wit, 6 months of oil of myrrh and purifying of the women, 6 months with sweet odors, that would be perfume and other things for the purifying of the women. What they were doing, in effect, is gathering these women from all over the world, but they wanted to make sure that none of these girls had any kind of diseases, any kind of rashes, any kind of blisters, none of those kind of things. So for a month, they were quarantined, kept very clean, purified, and so forth. Otherwise, they would never be able to come into the king's presence. Verse 17, Esther 2 and verse 17. And the king loved Esther above all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Now, brethren, pause here. Take a deep breath again. Understand, God worked this out. God put her there. God put her, made her that age. He made her beautiful. He made her, qualified in their eyes and everything to win this beauty contest, because at this point that's all it is. Even though during these 12 months I believe they were taught the customs of the court and how to curtsy and whatever that was expected of the king, but basically it was poise, beauty, and maybe a little talent, like can you play the stringed instrument or something like a beauty contest today, but it was mainly just a beauty contest. Verse 18. Then the king made a great feast to all his princes and his servants, even Esther's feast. So it's dedicated. This feast is dedicated to Esther. She's the guest of honor. And I believe King Ahasuerus was learning as he went. You notice he doesn't ask her to dance and show her beauty to everybody. He made that mistake and lost Vashti, who he had a good relationship with. She was a very good queen. And he made a release to the provinces. In other words, it's what would we have? We would have a day off. What do they call it when they close all the government offices an official holiday, government holiday. He gave gifts according to the state of the king. So, if king had a big territory, he gave him a big gift. If he had a little place, he gave him a little gift. Verse 19. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Verse 20. Esther had not yet showed her kindred, that she was Jewish, nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai as when she was brought up with him. Brethren, this is a beautiful verse to me, Esther 2 and verse 20. It shows that Esther, even though she's in the king's court, she could have got the big head. She could have said, hey, I made it on my beauty, I made it on my own, or whatever. But even though she's been in the king's court, she still looks to Mordecai for guidance and for all that he has to give her by way of trust and support. He was her people. He was her father instead. She trusted Mordecai's judgment implicitly and completely. That it's just a beautiful thing. Honor your father and your mother. She was doing a very godly thing here. And brethren, you've got to see God's hand in this. Now, they're all living there, going back and forth and everything, and Mordecai comes as close as he can because he's keeping an eye on her. He wants to make sure nothing's going to happen to her. But notice God's hand in this. Mordecai learns of an assassination plot against Ahasuerus. Now, that's big stuff. People are usually careful about that, but he was in the right place, right time. God had to put him there, and he heard about it. Verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, and it gives their names, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth, they were angry, and they sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. That's assassination plot is what it was. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen. And Esther then, in turn, certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. In other words, it went on the record. There's some conspirators that are out seeking your life. And as you read down the next few verses, the conspirators were captured, tried. I suppose they were tried. They were hanged. They got the evidence on them. Let's go to the next chapter, Esther 3 and verse 1. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman. That's a name we're going to see a bunch, brethren. He promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Notice he's an Agagite. And advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. So Haman's way up there. It looks like he's the number two man in all the kingdom, over 127 nations. But he's an Agagite, we'll see. And all the king's servants, verse 2, that were in the king's gate, they bowed and they reverenced Haman. They just like the Romans were known to the populace as gods, these people set themselves up as gods to be worshipped, reverenced, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Mordecai would not give to man what is only due to God. And you can put in your notes, brethren, Matthew chapter 23, because we don't worship men. Jesus said, don't call people your rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ. Call no man father upon your earth. Neither be you called masters, for one is your master, even Christ. And then he gives the balance. He says, the greatest among you shall be your servant, and that's the way we're to live, and that's the way we see Mordecai living. And then he also says, whosoever will exalt himself shall be abased, and whoever shall be humble shall be exalted. It's almost like Jesus Christ had this exact example of Haman from Esther here when he said these words. Let me have you turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 15, brethren. I want to point out something about Agagites, because Haman was an Agagite. That means that he was a descendant of Amalek. You'll remember that Moses encountered the Amaleks right out of Egypt as they were headed for the Promised Land. It says, and you don't have to turn there, you're on your way to 1 Samuel 15, but it says in Exodus 17:8 that they came on to Amalek, and he fought with Israel. And Moses said to Joshua, choose out some men to fight with Amalek. And that's the version where Moses was standing, and as long as he held his arms up, they prevailed against Amalek. And when his arms got tired and his arms started coming down, Amalek would prevail. And so they put some big rocks under Moses' arms, and they prevailed over Amalek. Well, in 1 Samuel 15 and verse 7, we saw that Saul was told by God to do this, and he smote the Amalekites from Havilah until you come to Shur. That's over against Egypt. Verse 8, and he took Agag, that's where you get Agagites, he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen and so forth. They didn't do what God said, and it ended up with Samuel having to kill Agag himself. Now, we're over in Esther. Let's turn back to Esther 3 and verse 3. But I just wanted you to know who this Haman was. He was one of the offspring, one of the descendants. He was an Agagite. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, why transgressest thou the king's commandment? In other words, why don't you bow down and do reverence to Haman? Verse 4, and it came to pass when they spoke daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matter would stand. You know, people are busybodies. They just went and told Haman, hey, Haman, I want you to be sure and notice there's one guy that won't bow down before you. I want to see if that would hold up. And so when they did face Mordecai, Mordecai stood up. In fact, he wasn't so concerned about his lineage getting out. He had told them that he was a Jew. Verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. He just, that's the way those kind of people are. He popped his cork. He blew his stack. He was so angry. There's one man that won't bow down to him, and he got so angry. Actually, Haman went berserk with hatred, and he was demonically motivated at that point to destroy all the Jews on the whole face of the earth, kind of like a Hitler way back then. Satan's tactics don't change, brethren. And what we see here with Haman was another of Satan's attempts to annihilate the Messianic line. Jesus Christ was to be born of the lineage of Judah. If you wipe out all the Jews, how can the Messiah, Jesus Christ, come? If all the Jews are dead, how would the Messiah come from the Jews? There were no more Jews. Jesus the Messiah could not come. Verse 6. And Haman, that's he here in verse 6, he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone. In other words, he wasn't going to waste his time on just one small potato like Mordecai. That was beneath his dignity. That's what that first part of the verse means. For they had showed him the people of Mordecai. You know, his hatred turned to all the Jews. Wherefore, we're in the middle of verse 6, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, that people of Mordecai. And that's all of them, from India all the way down to Ethiopia, 127 nations, every man, woman, and child. And then, going down through here, not to belabor this chapter, Haman convinced the king that the Jews were enemies of the state. They were out to get the king. They were no good citizen. And he promised the king this tremendous revenue if the king would let Haman have his way. And it was revenue that the king could use in his war efforts. And so the king signed off on the plan. I guess he probably thought, I don't know any Jews, and if they're that bad, we need to get rid of them. And then he did something that they did in those days. He irrevocably sealed the decision with his ring. And once the king did that, it could not be revoked. He said, all the Jews are to die. Ahasuerus signed on to all the Jews being dead. So that's, you see, it's getting very, very serious for, let's say, the people of God. And brethren, it's going to be like that for us in the end time. The people of God are not going to have any hope unless our hope is where it's supposed to be placed, in Jesus Christ. Let's go to verse 13, Esther 3 and verse 13. All the world is notified that you're supposed to kill the Jews on a certain day. And the letters were sent by a post or postman into all the king's provinces. And here's what you're supposed to do with Jews. You're to destroy them. You're to kill them. You're to cause them to perish. Seems a little redundant. But, you know, get rid of every last one of them is the way it read. All Jews, young and old, little children, women, in one day, just get it all over with in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is in the month of Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. Okay, see, that was the motivation. That was the appeal. You kill a Jew, you get to keep all of his possessions. That's just the way that they had it set up. Let's go to Esther chapter 4 now. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, I mean, this was world news. Mordecai, he rent his clothes, he put on sackcloth and ashes. He went out into the midst of the city and he cried with a loud and a bitter voice. Mordecai is fasting. He's praying. He's beseeching God, very much like we see Habakkuk doing at the beginning of the sermon today. God's hand is in this. He is appealing to God. This is a terrible thing. Mordecai was a learned man. He was a very brilliant man. He knew that Jesus Christ was coming from the tribe of Judah. And now they're going to all be wiped out. Now, he didn't say, well, you know what? God's going to have to handle that. I'm going fishing today. That's too big for me. I'm not going to get involved. He heard about it. He knew about it. He threw himself into it entirely. And he went into fasting and prayer. And they didn't just fast for 24 hours, brother. Verse 2. And came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. He was making a tremendous protest of what was happening. Verse 3. And in every province, wherever the king's commandment and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews. Yeah, your time is up. You're going to be dying, fasting and weeping and wailing. And many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Many of the Jews around the world were fasting and praying because to them the handwriting was on the wall. All the people are going to rise up and kill you, and they got the king's blessings to do it. Verse 4, and so Esther's maids and her chamberlains came, and they told it to her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved. I don't know how we can put the right emphasis on that. It just tore her heart out. She was ripped to shreds. She probably was sick to her stomach. And she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai and to take away his sackcloth from him, but he received it not. You know, she tried to tell him to, stand up, wash off and everything, but no, he was going to continue his fast. Then called Esther for Hathach, one of the king's chamberlains, whom he had appointed to attend upon her, and she gave him a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. So, why are you fasting and praying, Mordecai? Because as I read up here, it seems that Esther knew what it was, but maybe she doesn't have all the details. Verse 6. So Hathach went forth to Mordecai under the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. Verse 8, also he gave them a copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther and to declare it unto her, and to charge her that she should go in to the king to make supplication to him and to make request before him for her people. Whoa, and that's a big, big thing. Mordecai said, Esther, you go into the king now and play, you know, play your trump cards. You go into the king and make supplication to him and make a request for the people and everything. In verse 9, and Hathach came and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Verse 10, again, Esther spoke unto Hathach and gave him command unto Mordecai. Esther 4:11, all the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king in the inner court who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death. So Esther's saying to Mordecai, do you know the rules that we have to play by here in the palace? If I go in there and, you know, it strikes him the wrong way, off goes my head right then and there. There's two men standing on both sides of the door with hatchets for that express purpose, you know, to protect the king and to, if in fact, the king doesn't even have to say anything. If he doesn't reach out that golden scepter, it says, you know, I'm a goner. Except such to whom the king should hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. She hadn't been in there for a month, and you're asking me just to go in there unannounced? It could be a death sentence. Okay, brethren, here's where what we're talking about today. God's hand is in this. God's working this out. The test is on Esther. Will she step up to the plate? You know, will she do what needs to be done? Or will she, as we see so many in the church today doing, just saying, well, you know what, not my job. You know, somebody in charge has to do it. Let somebody else do it, but I'm not going to do it. Now, we've seen Mordecai stand up. Now, is Esther going to stand up? They told Mordecai Esther's words, verse 13. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with yourself that you shall escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. Just because you're in the palace, you're still a Jew. You'll die like everybody else. Now we come to one of my favorite verses in the Bible, Esther 4 and verse 14. This verse says so much. This is Mordecai talking to young, beautiful Esther, who's got a big, big decision to make. Will she go to the king, or will she just, you know, wing it on her own? He says, for if you altogether hold your peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. See, Mordecai understood the principle, brethren. Do we understand the principle? Whether or not we do what God has given us to do, the plan of God is going to work out. It's going to stay on schedule. We're not going to cause God to falter. Deliverance to the Jews will arise from another place. The Jews are going to be saved. Make no mistake about it. So Esther could say, well, that's good news. I don't have to do it. They're going to be saved. But notice, but you and your father's house shall be destroyed. So you're not going to get out of it alive, Esther. And then here's the big clincher, and this is where the title of today's sermon comes from. Mordecai says to Esther, and who knows whether you are come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Maybe God has been setting up all of this deal, the beauty contest, the king, Haman, and all of it to see if you will stand up before the king, tell him that you are a Jew, ask him to save the people. It was no accident, brother, that Queen Esther stood alone. It was by God's design. God's hand is in this. Mordecai could clearly see God's hand in all the circumstances. Can we see God's hand in the difficult and sore trials in which we find ourselves today? You might go, oh, those are biblical times. Things were so much different. No, brethren, it's the same for us today. Now, it might not be as big as saving all the Jews, but it's important to God. It's important to the plan of God. And it doesn't get any bigger than that. Will we step up to the plate? Will we stand alone? Will we take a stand for the truth of God? Will we do what God asks us to do? Will we be that shining light? Can we see God's hand in the difficult and sore trials in which we find ourselves? That's why I started off with Habakkuk. We can look back and go, boy, God was right on top of it. God knows exactly what's going to have happened. Have faith. Have patience. You know, God's going to work it out. Now, had Esther declined to take a stand, destruction and ruin would have been the result for her and all of her family. But God's plan would have prevailed anyway. The Jews would have been preserved some other way. Someone else would have taken Esther's crown. And we're told, let no man take your crown. So Mordecai understood what was going on. Mordecai saw the hand of God in this. He saw God's hand in everything. He knew that God's plan was going to come to fruition. Do we know that God's plan is going to come to fruition? And do we know what our part is in it? Are we going to do what we're supposed to do? And you can put in your notes, brethren, Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose. We're called according to His purpose, just as Esther was. Verse 15, then Esther bade them return to Mordecai this answer. Verse 16, so she gives him a positive answer. Go gather all the Jews that are present in Shushan. Fast for me. Don't eat or drink. 3 days. That's a long fast, brethren. You know what kind of shape you're in after 3 days? No food, no water, neither eat nor drink, day nor night. Because, see, some people count fasting just during the day. This is a full 24-hour fast, 48-hour fast, 72-hour fast. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I die, I die. If I perish, I perish. You know, she stepped up to what God had for her to do. She says, I'll do it. And let me tell you, she was scared as she could be, right down to her little princess slippers. Verse 17. So Mordecai went his way, and he did all according to what she had asked him. Chapter 5 and verse 1. And it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel. She's going to get all dressed up, absolutely beautiful. And she stood in the inner court of the king's house, over against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house, over against the gate of the house. And brethren, we know the story. Courageously, Esther overcame her fear and trepidation. She stepped up to take on the job that God had given her. She exhibited an enormous amount of courage as she approached the king, to whom she had not been summoned. She might die in an instant. She didn't know. Verse 2. And it was so when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court. Can you imagine how frail, how weak she was? She hasn't eaten anything or drank anything for 3 days. She can hardly think. The thoughts are racing through her mind. She might die in the instant. I mean, he's got queens galore lined up. If she's dead, he might decide, just like he did with Vashti, I can't have women coming in here just any old time, off with her head. Find me the next beautiful one. There's an endless, bottomless bucket of these beautiful women. That could have been going through her head. But he saw her standing there, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter, which was in his hand. So Esther drew near, and she touched the top of the scepter. And so you better have a very good reason for going before the king and imposing yourself upon him. He's got all this business that's going on. And so the king asked her what it was that she wanted. What was, he didn't put it ugly. He didn't say, what was so important you had to come in here and interrupt me. He was quite civil, it seems like. At least that's the way I read it. He says, what will you have, Queen Esther, in verse 3? What is your request? It shall be given you up to half of the kingdom. I mean, he loved her and gave her, wealth, incredible wealth, if she asked for it. And Esther answered, if it seemed good to the king, let the king and Haman, that's the enemy that wants to kill all the Jews, come this day into the banquet that I have prepared for him. And so, brethren, we don't have time to go into it. But what Esther did is she set up a meeting with the king and with Haman. And, of course, Haman took it that he was being honored. It was all about him. And then we had you have to see God's hand in this and believe, brethren, have the faith that God is working in our lives ever bit this much. It's for sure that God has called us. He has something important for us to do, to learn, to see, to be examples and all those kind of things. On that night, Esther 6 and verse 1, the king couldn't sleep. Why did he have insomnia on this night? Yeah, he's going to get together with Haman tomorrow. He's going to get together with the queen tomorrow. This night he couldn't sleep. And so he said, bring me something to read. They brought him the book of Chronicles where they kept track of everything. That's where he found out that Mordecai was the one that had turned in these two assassins. And he said, what did we do for that guy that saved, spared my life, saved us all the trouble and everything? Well, he hadn't done anything for him. So he looks out in the garden the next day, and there's Haman out there. And he says, oh, Haman, come in here. Let me ask you a question. What would you do if there was somebody that the king really wanted to honor? Well, Haman was the big head, thought, man, he couldn't be talking about anybody but me. And Haman said, man, put the king's robe on him and put him on your big royal stallion and lead him through the city in a one-man parade with all the splendor and, a bit like a big brass band, boom, 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 here he comes down the street and say, this is the man that the king wants to honor. Haman says, that's what I would do. Of course, Haman's thinking it's going to be him. And the king says, okay, good, I like that idea. Go get Mordecai and do it exactly that way. And Haman, boy, he was crestfallen. He couldn't believe, that this had backfired on him. And so he goes through the streets, leading the horse himself, crying out himself, this is the man, Mordecai, that the king wants to honor. Well, he goes home that night to face his wife and everything. Look at Esther 6 and verse 13. And brethren, understand, there were evil spirits that permeate pagan cultures. They're not praying to the true God. And Haman told his wife and all his friends that what had befallen him that day. And then said the wise men and his wife, Zeresh, said unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews before whom you have begun to fall, you're taking a slide here all of a sudden, Haman, you shall not prevail against him, but shall surely fall before him. See, there were superstitious people. And that's exactly what happened. So Haman fell, he got hung on his own gallows and everything. Brethren, see God's hand in the life of Esther. But then say, it's the same way with us. God's hand is in all of these things. Yes, things are getting bad. Yes, things look dark. Yes, everything is going against us. But understand, have the faith. We will prevail. Our enemies will be hung on their own gallows. That's what we're supposed to learn from this. As a result of Esther's stand, the Jewish ancestors of Jesus Christ were delivered from genocide. For those saints with whom God is working today, tests and trials are going to be coming, because God has specifically designed and allowed unique situations for His purposes. We think, oh, this is a terrible trial. Yoo-hoo, God, do you know about it? Yes, God knows about it. That's what Habakkuk needed to learn. That's what we need to learn. The rest of the book of Esther is about how Mordecai was elevated to be the number two man in the kingdom. God did it. God's hand was in that. That's the way God's going to deal with us. He's going to make us kings and rulers and priests in the world tomorrow. And when Mordecai got to that high position, he was able to reverse Haman's decree to have all the Jews exterminated. All those enemies who were set to kill the Jews were in turn killed themselves. Now, brethren, you might say, well, things like that don't happen to me. They do. Every detail is important to God. Let's make sure that we're not stepping aside trying to avoid what God is wanting us to learn. Let's be prepared, like Queen Esther, to step up to the plate, to face what God has allowed to be in front of us. Not being fearful, but being courageous, as she was. Christians have no choice but to take a stand. God inspired the book of Esther to be written so that we might understand some of those lessons that we need to learn today. We will not be devoured. We will not be overcome by trials. God will see us through. God's hand is in our lives. We are the children of God.